listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As Western elites face down the threat to their hegemony globally from Russia, China, and a rising multipolar world in general, a similar effort is being carried out over the lifeblood of civilization, information. Here in the U.S., the government has moved further against RT, the international Russian news outlet, by requiring that its American subsidiary, RT America, register by Monday as a foreign agent. For more on that and on the struggle for information generally, we spoke with Piers Robinson, who's the chair in politics, society, and political journalism at the University of Sheffield in the UK. We spoke with him via Skype from the UK Friday.
This is a further ratcheting up of a campaign which has been underway, I think, for a number of years now. It's going to be interesting sort of for people who study this kind of thing to actually identify the point at which this all started. But my sense is that really from about 2012, 13 onwards, you see an initiation and then a ratcheting up of attempts to start to try and close down RT in terms of its potential to broadcast to people in the West and to present alternative viewpoints and so on. And I'm pretty sure some of this ties up with some of the broader geopolitics in terms of what's been going on in Syria and also the Ukraine as well, and a clear change in tack in terms of starting to square up, as it were, against Russia, or to start to sort of push Russia into the threat category over the last 3 or 4 years. And I think what we've got now with these kind of legislative moves now, this is just the latest and perhaps most serious sort of step which is being taken. You're absolutely right. It's occurring in the UK as well, but we have a similar set of processes at work. And it's really interesting because I study propaganda, and looking at this from the propaganda sort of point of view, it's interesting to see the number of activities that you have in play at the moment, which some of it is directly linked to RT, but some of it is more broadly about trying to control the information environment. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the sort of the Facebook and Google algorithms being developed in order to filter sort of material which is on the web. You have these kind of concrete actions against RT and so on, both in the UK and also in America. You then have these think tanks, and there's this think tank called European Values Think Tank, which has been listing academics and journalists who appear on RT, and they published a report a few weeks back listing 2,500 people. And that's another plank, I think, of this kind of propaganda campaign. And what you've also had, and I've sort of been caught up in this myself personally, is actual attacks on individuals, you know, through Twitter and so on, for appearing on RT, etc. And there actually, you know, there appear to be sort of a number of planks to this concerted information war stroke propaganda drive to really try to limit the potential of RT and alternative and independent media to actually present people with a slightly different viewpoint from the one that dominates in the mainstream media. So I one has to be careful about exactly what one says, but there are all the indications here of a fairly well coordinated, probably loosely coordinated between various groups, but still the same coordinated propaganda campaign to try and sort of pull back control over the information environment in the West, and it has all of these different planks to it, and so on. And yeah. So it's very interesting and very serious, and as I'm sure you'd agree, deeply worrying at this point in time. Listing names reminds us all, of course, of the McCarthy era and what happened then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of the Hollywood 10, for example, as we, you know, discuss these particular actions now. But, the enabling narrative for much of this has been the Russiagate, allegation. Russia hacked the election. One of the mechanisms that was used was Russian propaganda. But even before the election season, we had Senator Jeanne Shaheen, for example, and other members of various Senate and House committees saying things like Shaheen did. The Russian propaganda is such a threat that it has a body count. Russian propaganda kills, she said. This enables all kinds of things. And you correctly, point out that there's multifaceted, like a multidimensional attack that's being launched, whether it's coordinate from the center or not. The naming of names, for example, I saw that Peter Laveau, who's the host of Crosstalk, posted on Facebook yesterday that someone that they had asked, who's a regular guest, is now afraid to appear because of the, negative publicity. So you're talking about, on the one hand, like restricting, the things that are allowed to be done, licensing or designating RT America as a foreign propaganda arm basically means that they can't hold broadcast licenses in the United States. So there's the angle of we're blocking your access to these audiences or to the use of these outlets. That's one area. Another is we're blocking your access to these sources. Another is we're painting a a haze over what you are. We're repositioning who you are through the audience over the broad spectrum of outlets that we are allowed to operate. And it seems to me that this is more than just purposeful. It has to, in a way, be coordinated, even if it's not where there's six guys having a meeting in a back room, but everyone looking at the landscape and saying, okay, the next thing that needs to be done is this.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's loosely coordinated. You have a constellation of interests and actors, right, and so on. But if there's one thing that the study of propaganda, whether it's the study of propaganda in Western countries or anywhere else in the world, or the study of propaganda throughout the Cold War era, if there's anything that tells you in terms of the information that we have now available about what was going on in those eras, is that these things are directed and so on, and importantly, huge amounts of resources are put into these kind of activities in order to shape perceptions. And it's something which has really been a kind of a black hole for a lot of academics for a long time and so on, partly because these things are very difficult to research and so on, and partly because academics who look at this tend to sort of get bracketed into this kind of conspiracy theory sort of territory, etc. But this really is a big part of governance in democracies and in liberal democracies. And you go back to Eddie Bernays in the first part of the 20th century talking about the invisible hand of government and the importance of propaganda. And there's a lot more activity and intentional directed activity going on than most people are aware of. Of course, that's no surprise, because propaganda activities or information operations, whatever, if you want to call it strategic communication, InfoWars, whatever label you might want to attach to it and so on, these things do rely heavily upon essentially secrecy and so on and not being obvious, etc. Otherwise, that they don't work effectively. But these are a big part of democracies. If you go into the economic realm, look at the tobacco industry throughout the 50s, 60s and 70s and look at how they were very successful at using PR techniques to try and sow seeds of doubt amongst Western populations as to the harmful effects of nicotine and so on. And they were very successful at holding back sort of legislative drives to control that for a long time. You know, a lot of money and a lot of activity goes into these, a lot of energy goes into these activities. And this, I'm pretty sure this is exactly what we're seeing in relation to this kind of, this. You know, on one level, it seems absolutely absurd, it's to kind of blame Russia for everything and so on. But of course, when you think about it, this works. This is such a politically effective tool for those people who are driving this, whether it's the DNC and the Democrats trying to distract attention from what Clinton was engaged with or what the Clinton team was engaged with in relation to the elections last year. Or whether it's this bigger picture in terms of the geopolitical situation, that the wars in the Middle East, the fact that Syria at the moment seems to be, as it were, whatever they were trying to achieve, and the overthrow of Assad, essentially, that's failed now in a fairly remarkable sort of geopolitical realignment within the Middle East. And, you know, the political incentive just to try and point towards Russia, point towards external actors as being the source of all trouble at home and so on. You know, there's huge political incentives to be doing that at the moment. And I think sort of these propaganda campaigns are the symptoms or the manifestations of those political interests.
You know, it's not just foreigners. I'm looking at this article about Marcus Papadopoulos. He has a press pass that gets him access to Parliament as editor of Politics First. He's a UK subject. This is a UK publication. But he appears on RT, like I do, from time to time. And because of that, there are Labour Party MPs that want to remove his press pass.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable on those specific kind of claims being, or the attacks on individuals. There was a Times leader a few weeks ago, which was listing MPs who appear on RT. There's the think tank that I mentioned, which is listing anybody appearing on RT. And so on, and those that kind of activity is remarkable in the sense that, you know, these aren't Russian agents. These are all in the case of members of parliament, these are all elected officials who are simply voicing their point of view, etc. And wherever they might be doing that, whether that's an RT or CNN or any other media outlets, it shouldn't really be a problem at all. And it should be seen as part of a healthy democracy, in fact, that democratically elected officials are allowed to get their voices heard and so on. So it is really quite remarkable how extreme it's becoming and how unreasonable, I guess is what you were getting at. I mean, it is extremely unreasonable. It's extremely unreasonable in irrational kind of allegations being thrown at Russia, especially this kind of threat creation which is going on at the moment, whether it's the ratcheting up of tensions through NATO. But it's ironic, or it's a double standard in the sense that, as we know full well now, that over the last 15, 16 years, it's been Western governments led by the US who have been the major instigators of acts of violence in the international system, whether it's the invasion of Iraq or Afghanistan or operations to try and overthrow Assad and so on. And at this point in history, when I think people are becoming aware of all of this much more than they were perhaps 5-6 years ago, you know, suddenly, right, put all the blame onto Russia or focus the attention on Russia as the bogeyman in the international system. It's completely unreasonable, irrational, and entirely inconsistent with any kind of objective reading of the facts of what we've seen over the last 16 years. And I'm sort of sitting here wondering how much longer are they going to get away with this for? Because, you know, sort of claims being made about Russia or the sort of inconsistency in terms of not dealing with, say, what happened in the American election, the DNC and all of these debates or these issues over leaked information and the rigging, in inverted commas, of the election. You know, at what point does that get addressed? It's such an obvious thing which needs to be addressed. And I just wonder, you know, the propaganda just seems to be getting very extreme. And the distinction between reality and what is being pushed at people through these propaganda drives is, it seems to be very big. And I just wonder, at some point, does this collapse? Is this, kind of, you know, with Vietnam at some point, you know, this light at the end of the tunnel narrative just was seen through by increasingly large numbers of people in America and the American elite and so on. That at some point, you know, the truth does have its day in all of this. So you sort of wonder how much longer they can keep on going at this. But but we'll see. I tend to try and stay optimistic on these things.
Right. I know.
But, you know, who knows?
You know, there's a few things to parse out of that, too. First, you know, you have the internal British politics that are involved in this particular episode. You have two Blairite Labour MPs who are attacking Papadopoulos because they see a chance to attack Corbyn, because Papadopoulos had his picture taken with Corbyn back in July and said, having a wonderful dinner and hopefully the next Prime Minister of the UK. So they get to basically, from inside the Labour Party, point to Corbyn and say, see, he's a Ruski lover or whatever. So that's the kind of game that went on inside the Democratic Party in the 40s. People point to McCarthy, but actually Truman was the one who, you know, sat at the beginning of the Cold War and all of that stuff, the whole change in attitude towards the USSR. And we find out later the back game while that was going on was they were planning to drop 250 nuclear bombs on Russia, on the Soviet Union, and the only reason that that didn't happen was because they got a bomb themselves before the 250 were built. So we had this whole propaganda game going on, but there was really a material process going on, and our backdrop now is war games from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula around Russia and China, which is a kind of a scary thing. But the other point that I wanted to make on this, and I wanted to probe with you, is that as we look at this developing further and looking at perhaps the weight of it, you know, coming down, we see polling data that shows that the, you know, as much as they talk about Trump polling at 37% or whatever, U.S. media polls almost in single digits. They're almost as unpopular as Congress, which is saying some in this country. The need for like a unanimous voice to block out any contrary information, you know, intensifies as the vector between the official narrative and reality grows. In other words, people, if they can't hear from anyone else a reification of their understanding that what they're saying isn't true from some other source, and it takes them that much longer to figure it out. I'm wondering, are we seeing an intensification of this process because people are starting to wake up and say, look, the media lies?
Yeah, I mean, two very interesting points. On the first one, on this idea of the material context and the international situation in relation to Russia and China, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you have a propaganda drive at the moment, and then you have, as it were, the material context and what's actually going on. And at the moment, I mean, I'm trying to sort of, the optimistic side of me, and this is, it might sound perverse, I'm saying this is an optimistic reading, but the idea that this is about trying to control domestic populations within the West by blaming Russia and trying to distract attention away from domestic issues is that I'm kind of hoping that that's what this propaganda drive is about.
Instead of World War III, I mean, it's optimistic negative, compared to that,
yeah,
right?
The negative interpretation is that actually the neocon stroke neoliberal axis in the American establishment is driving for war in the international system. Right. And it seems to me to be naive to discount that possibility entirely. Right. And one doesn't want to be an alarmist, but We have seen a very significant degree of conflict in the international system, as I mentioned before, in the last 16 years. We knew from the Chilcot report this year, which came out in Britain into the Iraq war, Chilcot released all of these documents with Blair and Bush discussing regime change ops, talking about hitting Syria, Iran, and when to do it, etc. So we know that the West has been using its military force, well, for a long time, but is specifically after 9/11 in relation to regime change wars in a very major way in the international system. And it's quite clear that that's been about positioning and trying to extend American influence and reach at a point in history where its dominance is seriously challenged by China and so on. And so the question is, are there elements here, and is this propaganda drive essentially part of trying to push people and mobilize support for some kind of significant military engagement beyond the massive military engagements we already have? Is this going to lead us into a conflict with Russia or China? John Bilger is concerned about China, a coming war with China, which he talks about in his latest documentary. And I think that's a real possibility, and that's something which we all of us have to be very alert to. And that could be one possible explanation for the propaganda drive. Although, as I say, kind of an oddly optimistic reading is this is more about just trying to control dissent and unrest domestically and so on by sort of distracting attention abroad, etc. Or it could be a bit of both. But I certainly think we should all be, given the level of force which is being used in the international system, given what we know about the American economy, whether you want to call it the military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower described it, or whatever, you have an engine there which is driven in large part by conflict and war and arms sales. Britain has this with Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. We're caught in a relationship where we have arms sales and so on, and they're highly dependent upon it for our economics, and it shapes and determines how we react to what's going on in the Middle East and what we actually do. So we need to keep an eye on that. The second thing you're talking about, this is definitely, I think there's this gap between reality and the fact that we have a point in history now where people have had the opportunity to go beyond mainstream media because of independent media, because of perhaps social media and the internet. This has meant that I think it's become much more challenging for the establishment, if you want to call it that, to actually sort of control perceptions in a way that they have done historically. And I think you do have an emergence of an increasingly strong counter movement or sort of progressive movement is how I describe it. I wouldn't call these people radicals or whatever, or revolutionary. These are just people who are into progressive politics, who want to change, address problems to do with inequality, conflict, and so on. And there is greater opportunity for people who are minded in that way to get information for alternative media. And that has forced their hand, yes. And that's why I think we see this ratcheting up. And this really moving into a phase of censorship with the internet in terms of these algorithms being used. And we see the returns to left-wing outlets and so on dropping off significantly because of these algorithms. So they're really moving into the censorship territory now. And I think, for sure, that is driven by the fact that there is this sort of fledgling space for, alternative viewpoints to be expressed. Now, how strong that is, the independent media and alternative media have been very, very important. How strong that is in relation to the mainstream media is unclear, although, again, trying to distinguish between being very pessimistic and optimistic, an optimistic reading of this is that you do have unprecedented drop in trust, support, etc., of mainstream media, and I think that in a way that's a very good thing, because it means that people are beginning to wake up to the fact that there is information manipulation extensively within the mainstream media. The downside to all of this is that I'm not quite sure how much that is then translating into positive mobilization. I think it is to an extent, but there's also, in terms of students who I teach, there's a lot of confusion out there, right? There's a lot of people who are sort of just simply don't know what to do, who to trust, who to read, and who to listen to. And I think it's really important at this point in time for academics and people such as yourself to sort of, you know, help people start to develop media literacy skills, and also help people develop the confidence to actually, right, well, I am going to start to use my own judgment, my own intelligence. I'm going to look at alternative media. Sure, I'll look at what the mainstream media are saying, and I'll listen to it and take it on board. But I'll then go and look for information elsewhere, and trying to sort of nurture the idea of the active democratic citizen, right? Right. Who is going to work a little bit harder than perhaps people have historically, is a really important thing to do, so that we can sort of harness, you know, the potential for independent media, alternative media that we have today.
Yeah.
I think a lot of effort needs to go into that. But for sure, back to your point, yeah, the intensification of the propaganda, I think, is because they realize, or various actors realize, that they're losing the trust and the support at the moment, as far as I'm aware, increasingly large section of the population simply don't trust, say, in the US mainstream media. Well, it's dropped from like 70% trust down to like 30% or something over the last 20 years. 30 years.
Mm. You've seen one of the criticisms of media in the West that goes back, and from a Marxist perspective, that goes back 100 years, is the fact that because it's owned by one particular class, that there's going to be a class bias to all of it, even if there's a diversity of ownership. But nevertheless, just the dynamics, the economics of the system have generated pretty much a monopoly situation, with an intensification of concentration of ownership to, you know, unanimity more or less now on viewpoints from, you know, Fox to, say, Democracy Now. And so when you have a phenomenon like the Libyan war, for example, where even Pacifica Radio, which I was affiliated with at the time, I'm trying to spoon feed them an article in February of 2011 from the Pakistan Observer reporting that U.S., U.K., French troops land in Libya. Could never get anyone to publish that publicly. So anyway, this is like a phenomenon that, that's a little snapshot of it, but a phenomenon that's been ongoing. And then suddenly the internet allows this explosion. So now, looking at Middle Eastern policy, I can look at Al Arabiya from Saudi Arabia, Al Jazeera from Qatar, Press TV from Iran, from Egypt, other places, various media, and then try to parse, as you say, the democratic work that needs to be done. This is what they're trying to shut down. What kind of defensive strategies have people used before when confronted with this? And, you know, what lessons are there perhaps for us in there on what is to be done?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I don't think I have a clear an answer to that one. I mean, in terms of historical examples of how people have reacted to this, I mean, in different eras with different media technologies available, if you look at, you know, there has always been underground stroke alternative press and so on, and magazines, so people can always engage in production of that sort of material. And with the internet, of course, there's a lot more potential for people to react to, you know, whether it's the concentration or the limitation of viewpoints you have in the mainstream media, by setting up alternative and independent media. And those are clearly, and this is what we see sort of working through over the last 10 years, and these are things which are happening. In a way, I think, I don't want to be a technological determinist about this, but the internet has provided the potential for what we see today, which is the challenge to the mainstream and the independent media. The problem is, and where I think we might make missteps as people who are progressives or people who are activists, is this idea that so once you've got this technology, then that's the end of the story. People can sort of take advantage of it and they can use it and challenge the mainstream. Is that, you know, the history of communications and so on, and of new technologies coming along, is that they frequently become subverted by existing structures of power, both political and economic. And I guess this is the danger of the internet at the moment, is that you have... Well, you already have the corporate takeover, right? In the sense, you know, Facebook, right. Google dominate the internet, and so on. And that gives tremendous power to powerful political and economic interests. So the internet, which is there free and open, is as it were, being subverted, or its radical potential is being subverted by, you know, the emergence of these essentially, you know, conglomerates or dominant business entities, in the same way that you had this kind of concentration of ownership with mainstream media sort of in earlier eras becoming well established. What needs to be done is probably bigger than sort of any one country or any one sort of political movement can actually achieve. But there needs to be some kind of drive, I think, for keeping the internet open as a genuine space to prevent companies such as Google and Facebook getting a stranglehold. Now, at the moment, the technology is there. You know, if people get fed up with Facebook, there are other alternatives that they can go to. If they get fed up with Google as a search engine, they can go elsewhere. And so this kind of struggle between the emerging independent alternative media versus the legacy and the dominant and the large corporate media, I'm hoping will continue. They can't close it down at this point in time with algorithms and all the other techniques which are being used. This will simply resurface again and so on. But you know, it also needs it. It needs more than this, and it also needs, and again, this is sort of, you know, I'm not quite sure if I have a clear vision on any of this, but this also requires political mobilization, which isn't just going on the internet, right? It requires a real drive for progressive politics and for people to rally around particular visions of what direction we can go in now. And it needs to be more than, you know, setting up on the internet or having what do you have with the internet? You have petitions being signed on the internet, etc. A lot of trust and hope is invested in the internet and being able to do things. And when actually we're really talking about the need for political change and challenges to the status quo as we have it at the moment, whether it's the wars that we see or the environmental problems that we have confronting us, or whether it's inequality, etc. And that requires people to mobilize, both taking advantage of the internet, but also I think politically we need to see some kind of progressive mobilization, grassroots mobilization, because that's how things get done at the end of the day, and that's how things get really affected. And that's in particular is how establishment figures or elites, this is when they start to feel really threatened and they really recognize that it's time for a change, is when you got people mobilizing, being able to watch RT, independent media, is perhaps the first step in people being able to develop new ideas about the world and what's going on. But it then needs to translate into proper grassroots political mobilization. And it's important to keep that in mind. And I think that's something which we all need to be working towards, as well as sort of fighting the battle of trying to keep the internet open, trying to fight the battle of allowing sort of people access to non-Western media in order to get a sense of alternative viewpoints.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
No problem.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. 100 years ago, Russia was consumed by revolution and unprecedented violence. It is not an understatement to say the Russian Revolution or Bolshevik coup d'etat was a defining moment of the 20th century. How did it change Russia and the world? Crosstalking the Russian Revolution, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Jeffrey Roberts. He's a professor of history at University College Cork and a member of the Royal Irish Academy. We also have Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. And, of course, we have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, as always, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Jeffrey Roberts, let me go to you first here. 100 years on, I will ask the most obvious question. Was it worth it?
Was it worth it? Yes, I think it was.
Why?
Because what the revolution showed was that it was possible to change the world. I mean, what happened in 1917 was that the people intervened in history, fundamentally changed the course of world history.
But there are those that say that it was a coup d'etat, that the Bolsheviks didn't represent the people, that represented a very severe ideology and absurd power.
What happened in Russia was a popular revolution. The Bolsheviks came to power on a wave of revolution that swept through Russia.
They were on a revolutionary mode or a Bolshevik revolutionary mode?
A revolutionary move. The Bolsheviks weren't a majority when they seized power, but they were a very strong minority, and they actually had a majority or a near majority in the urban areas. So the point is, you know, it wasn't just a Bolshevik coup d'etat or insurrection that happened in Russia. There was a revolutionary upsurge, and the Bolsheviks were the beneficiary of it.
Okay.
And the point of this revolutionary upsurge was to, you know, not to just bring to power a particular group of people. It was all about, you know, reimagining the future, trying to find a completely different way.
But the people paid a very high price for that view of the world. Mark, I can see your position quite clear here.
Go ahead. No.
Same question.
Very nuanced. I do not consider myself a communist, maybe a post-Leninist. My wife is a communist.
Post-Leninist.
And a post-Leninist, yeah.
go.
Not a post-Marxist, a post-Leninist. I want to speak perhaps as IR theorist on the international relations level, what the Soviet Union meant to the world. It meant the end of Western colonialism and imperialism. Without the Soviet Union, the ability of the Third World to achieve independence, certainly within the time frame it did, it simply wouldn't have happened.
Well, Mark, you can make the same argument that the end of the First World War saw the end of the Western empires. The Russian
it
set the seeds of it. Eventually, it did decades later. We just had the collapse of the Russian Empire. One cannot say that was necessarily part of the same process.
Up until the 1980s, Nelson Mandela, who was supported by the Soviet Union and himself was a communist of sorts, was still opposed by Western governments, the United States, the United Kingdom, up until he succeeded. And then suddenly he's become, the hero rather
than
the
But that's the whole point. That's the whole point. It's not just about the Soviet Union. It's about ideology.
Absolutely.
And that is the biggest outcome of that political transformation. You can use revolution, you can use coup d'etat, whatever you choose, but the fact of the matter is the rest of the century, or almost the rest of the century, was defined by the ideology that eventually took power in Russia.
Well, there is absolutely no doubt that the Russian Revolution played a role in the major role in the 20th century history, and most of that influence was positive. Maybe not on Russia itself, but on the world in general, definitely positive. But what I think is important, and what I think is not discussed in Russia and in the West, we see certain traits of this revolution, the worst ones, revealing themselves very clearly in the West right now. Look, destruction of monuments, monopolization of science and the media.
Controlling speech.
The mania of finding spies, not only foreign spies, but people who don't fit a certain ideology at home. So these are scary things. If you ask me about the most negative aspects of the Russian Revolution, I can refer you to the modern West, to the United States, and the EU, and you will see a lot of them.
Okay.
But talking about the revolution as a whole, I think we can agree on something. I will suggest you an image. The Russian Revolution was like an elephant in the dark room that three philosophers, three wise men, tried to touch, being blind.
To describe.
Yeah, one of them touched the leg and said, oh, the elephant is like a column. The other one touched the trunk and said, it is more flexible. The third one touched the tail and said, it's like a rope. So if you ask me about the Russian Revolution, was it a tragedy for Russia with millions of people dead, that a dramatic fall in living standards for the majority, a huge majority of the population? I will say yes.
And the living standards were pretty low at the time.
Absolutely. Then will you ask me, was it a popular uprising with people basically supporting the Bolsheviks during their civil war, opting for their own government and not an opposition liaised with the West? Yes. Was it an event that positively influenced the Western countries, that encouraged them to introduce the social safety networks?
Yes. Workers' rights.
Women's rights. Okay, literacy.
It's like an elephant where you have positive things and negative ones, but the negative ones are now evident in the
Jeffrey,
West.
I was trained as a historian. One always has to stay away from the sense of historical inevitability. But why did the Bolsheviks win? There were more than one revolution that year, okay? There were different trends that were overlapping simultaneously. Why did they win? Was it just violence?
No, the Bolsheviks won. Well, three reasons. Firstly, they had popular support, yeah? Secondly, because of Lenin's leadership. And thirdly, because the revolutionary events took place in the context of the First World War. And think about the Bolsheviks in 1917. They were the anti-war party. They were the peace party. That was enormously important to their popularity. The other thing you have to remember about the Bolsheviks, of course, is that when they seize power in Russia, they don't see themselves as just being involved in a Russian revolution. They see their action as part of a broader world revolution. They see the Russian revolution leading to a global revolution. From the Bolshevik point of view, the whole future of humanity was at stake in their actions in Russia.
So, Mark, what went wrong? Because you're all saying this was very idealistic, it was very painful, it was very, very costly, but we ended up with something like Stalinism.
Can I just interject that? What went wrong was the Civil War and the foreign intervention that followed. Yeah? That's what went wrong. That's the context in which the revolution begins to degenerate, in which Bolshevism, which was a kind of popular revolutionary movement, begins to take on these kind of bureaucratic, authoritarian, repressive features which become embedded in the Soviet Union. So it's the
and
Civil
then it became
War
embedded in the system
it's a civil war. It's a very important role that's played by foreign intervention by Western capitalist states trying to strangle Bolshevism.
I want to add to the causes of the Bolshevik success just a little bit. I agree completely with what Jeffrey said, especially the anti-war party aspect of Bolsheviks. When the Kerensky and the provisional government seized power after the February Revolution that preceded the Bolshevik Revolution, they wanted to continue the war. This war that many Russians, Russia had already suffered some 6 million casualties at that point. The country was suffering from famine. They were exhausted. They couldn't understand why they were fighting what they saw as an imperialist war between imperialist European powers. They wanted out. Another thing, the Bolsheviks were incredibly disciplined as a party. They understood power. They knew how to take control of railroad stations, telegraph stations. They understood the nodes of power and communication that make society work and how to take
and their foes were opposed to each other as well. They had a sense of unity. Really.
The third thing I would say is they had the support of the military, and this was crucial, particularly the Navy. Defections from the military at this point were 34,000 a month. And they were flocking to the Bolsheviks because the Bolsheviks were promising the end of the war. And they supported the Bolsheviks all through the February Revolution up until the culmination with the October Revolution. And without that crucial military support, I'm not talking officers, I'm talking the rank and file soldiers, particularly in the Navy, the Kronstadt sailors, the Aurora, and so on. They were crucial to being able to take power on the streets and hold government buildings.
Dima, is the ideology, is violence embedded in the ideology, or is that just the political tool to maintain power? Because I think they're conflicting trends. This is an idealistic movement, a lot of things that we'd heard in the 19th century in the socialist labor movement here. But once it comes to pass, once you come to power, you don't want to let it go. And you have to, for the good of the people or the good of the party or the good of the ideology. And I think that's also, I agree with the Civil War. But once they had a foothold, they would do anything it took to keep it.
Well, I would say that violence is akin to all radical ideologies, including neoliberalism or now
capitalism. Agreed.
And the mechanism of repression is very simple with radical ideologies. We are right on the footstep towards happiness for the whole world. And who is preventing us from having it? Mm-hmm. Just 2 million people in Donbass? Smash them, These Alawites in Syria who stick to Assad? Kill them. This is the attitude of the West, and that was the attitude of the Bolsheviks, but not from the very beginning. You know, I think it's a very important question why the Bolsheviks came to power. Two reasons. First, the February Revolution. You know, now in Russia, we don't separate these two things. We're talking about one revolution, not about February and October.
And we're going to talk, we're going to talk about that.
I think it's right, because without February, there would be no October. What happened in February was that a bunch of liberal revolutionaries came to power and revealed themselves absolutely unfit to govern. We have very similar people now opposing Putin. They were very good at propaganda, Western-supported propaganda against the Tsar.
But hapless.
Yeah, 90% of the Russian population in February 1917 were convinced that Rasputin slept with the Empress, that he was a German agent, that she was a traitor. All this nonsense, you
know. Was that fake news?
The fake news of the revolution. A good point, Mark.
And fake news was much more important, because if you talk about the economic situation in February 1917 was not dramatic.
Let me jump in.
People
here.
After our break,
we'll continue our discussion on the Russian Revolution. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing the Russian Revolution 100 years on. Okay, Damon, go ahead and finish up your point.
So the first reason why Bolsheviks came to power was the inability of liberals to govern after February 1917. And the second reason was that when the Civil War really broke out, most of the Tsarist generals, Russian patriots, they took the side of the Reds. This is something that is not often mentioned.
But that was for the protection of the state, the people, because it certainly couldn't have been ideology.
I think I can give you a very good personal example. Alexei Brusilov, the famous general who defeated the Austrians in the First World War, when the army officers asked him, Alexei Ivanovich, what shall we do, you know, there is a civil war going on. He said, governments come and go, Russia stays. Serve the government that we have, the Reds. Because the otherwise are liaised with our enemies from abroad. They are not able to govern. They want to return to the past.
What was his fate, ultimately?
Well, he died his own natural death in the 20s, in 1926, having written a book which was written by a patriot and a monarchist, but in which he praised Trotsky.
Okay. Well, I don't want to go into Trotsky. Okay, Jeffrey, I want to ask you something here, because I think this is what something one of our viewers here is. I live here. And you know, this is the 100th anniversary. Not much excitement. I don't hear a lot of conversation, certainly academics and pundits and commentators. But on the whole, it's not a big deal. There's a lot of ambivalence.
I think there's probably more discussion going on in Russia about the revolution than you might imagine. Russian public opinion is divided about the revolution, isn't it? You know, there's some people, half the population thinks it was, on the whole, not a bad thing.
56%.
Yeah, okay. And the other half, or whatever it's, 44%, are very hostile.
I don't even know where to go. Yeah. I mean, haven't described the elephant. Well, I don't know.
As a Russian, how do you feel about it?
Because
having studied it, I have to say I have extreme ambivalence. And I think that's the word.
Well, the problem is that this anniversary, it unleashed a lot of more passions in the West than in Russia.
That's what I noticed.
The passions are completely misguided.
As usual.
The Economist compared Putin to the Tsar and said that he doesn't want to celebrate the centenary because he is afraid of sharing the fate of Nicholas II. This is stupid.
Mark already mentioned it. Fake news. More fake news.
But the reality is that right now the West reminds me of the times of the Third International. The idea that we can't have liberal capitalism only in the United States and the EU, we have to spread it all over the world, or we will be smashed. That's a completely Bolshevist idea, right? The destruction of monuments, like looking at history from today's viewpoint and saying that this guy was a slave owner, that guy was a racist, it's the same thing.
Well,
the Bolsheviks,
one thing I can tell you guys
generals.
Is that you go into any city and town in this country and you're still probably going to find a statue of Lenin. There's still a lot out there. Mark,
that's nice.
What
history stays.
We already heard that it was the Civil War. Was it embedded in the ideology of a totalitarian strain that culminated in Stalin? Because the great argument is, we've already heard about Trotsky, Bukharin, and there could have been different variants, different paths. I'm not convinced of that. I think it's a very totalitarian ideology.
I'm not a big fan of the word totalitarian. I think that itself is an ideology that was created in the West in the wake of World War II to try to equate fascism and communism, which I believe is a false equation.
I think it's erroneous.
Yeah.
Yes,
I think we have to remember that the Soviet Union was born not only in internal struggle, but it was, from the moment of its creation, it was attacked from the capitalist world.
Under siege.
It wasn't. This is left out of a lot of Western history books, that in 1918, the Western powers and Japan, most European countries, the United States, they invaded the nascent Soviet Union in the middle of the Civil War to try to strangle the Soviet
Union. Strangle it in the cradle.
And I mean, we're talking one little incident that's, you know, just in the past few years been recognized by, you know, British press, The Guardian and others. Churchill was a military commander of the British Expeditionary Force. He used chemical weapons on Russian towns. And that attack from outside helped solidify the support of the Russian people with
the Reds,
the Bolsheviks, and helped. There was a siege mentality. There was a paranoia that developed during the Soviet Union, but with good reason.
Perhaps I could answer your question. I mean, Bolshevism changed. Yeah, the party changed. Its ideology.
Well, yeah,
changed.
There were purges. People disappeared.
The Bolshevism of 1917 is not the same as the Bolshevism that emerged from.
And is it because of the Civil War and because of the siege?
Obviously, this is the historical argument. You know, is the authoritarianism and totalitarianism of Bolshevism inherent in its ideology, its organization, its personalities, or is a result of historical circumstances? Is it shaped by the circumstances? Now, my view is that it's shaped by the circumstances. But going back to your other question about violence and power, for the Bolsheviks, it was never just about violence and power for their own sake. It was about violence and power in the pursuit of utopia. And it's really important to understand, you know, the radical utopian nature of the Bolshevik Revolution, of the Soviet project.
You know, in retrospect, would you say that was a dangerous goal to have, utopia?
I think that is one of the lessons. I agree. You know, idealism is not practical politics.
Right.
You know, revolutions do devour their children. Yeah. So you have to be careful what you wish for. But that's not to say that the ideas themselves, you know, the idealism, is anything inherently wrong with it. One of the interesting things about the Western coverage of the 100th anniversary, the predominant theme is actually, okay, yeah, there were all these negative consequences arising from the Russian Revolution, but actually, the ideas of the revolution, yes, that inspired the revolution, remain relevant today. Particularly relevant today, when, you know, so-called neoliberal capitalism is experiencing, you know, such a crisis, and there is a need to try and, you know, imagine alternatives, imagine different futures, to do some different things, yeah. And, you know, the Russian Revolution, and indeed, you know, the Soviet experience as a whole has lessons to teach us both negative.
And that probably explains why Russians are very, very adverse to revolutions and dramatic political changes.
Let's talk about numbers of people today. Today in Russia, 56% of people regret the passing of the Soviet Union, but only 12% would like to see it restored as it was.
Yeah.
In Eastern Europe, in Central and Eastern Europe, a recent poll by the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development says that over half, some 54% of people, would like to see the return of a command economy.
Yes.
We've seen repeated polls in Romania and Hungary that say their lives were better off under the Soviet system. In the United States, millennials, a majority of them, some 51%, would prefer to live in a socialist or communist country. And as this is YouGov, and of the total U.S. population, 34% would rather live in a socialist country.
You know what that reminds me of is when I was in graduate school at Berkeley, you know, and I was going back and forth between communist Poland and Berkeley, and I told people in Poland that there are more communists in Berkeley than all of Poland here. Go ahead.
Well,
these millennials, I mean, they should have, if we could send them back back in time. Let them live in Albania in the 1960s, okay?
They don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I think that you asked a very important question. Was violence, like, innate in an ideology? Well, I would say that any utopia, any aggressive utopia, can spawn violence.
Look at Pol Pot. Absolutely. I mean, that was a utopian.
No, not only Pol Pot. The idea to have something like encouraging feminism in Afghanistan, that's an explosive idea, which has been realized, or they tried to realize it for 20 years. The idea of radically changing Ukraine, making it an enemy of Russia, destroying all the communist past in Ukraine, that's a revolutionary idea.
You're saying absolutism, having absolutes, is an extremism. You need violence to make it,
absolutely,
to get there.
In a way, you know,
any change, any drastic political change.
We can agree that the Russian Revolution probably taught the West in the past more than it taught the Soviet Russia, so the West avoided a lot of our mistakes. But there are a few things that the Russians learned, and we have got immunized from these wrong ideas from the beginning. For example, let me give you an example. The idea that a writer could be made better or worse by his origin. You know, in the Soviet Union, writers were divided into proletarian ones and bourgeois ones. So now when Russians hear about women's writing, gay writing, immediately we have a very skeptical attitude, and we say, be a good writer who happens to be a woman.
Right.
Be a good writer who happens to be gay.
Oh, God forbid the right world could learn something from Russia, considering the environment here.
So there are certain bits of immunization that we got from this revolution, and one of them is that we're adverse to any kind of revolution now.
You know, we're rapidly running out of time here. Jeffrey, one of the things I think is very interesting is, during the Cold War, we had this captive nations concept in the West. You know, a lot of people don't understand how much Russians suffered during the Revolution, during the Civil War, during the Second World War, and, you know, and one can make the argument that the entire breadth of the Soviet Union, its culture, and it was attacked, and it was
destroyed
in many ways. I mean, I'm thinking of the Orthodox Church. Okay, a lot of people don't understand how much Russians survived because of the pursuit of utopia and an ideology.
Well, yeah, okay. Culture was destroyed, but an alternative was put in place. Yes, I mean there was.
We're still here. Okay.
There was a reconstruction of culture, of Soviet culture, which wasn't completely bad. I mean, which actually persists this day.
And nostalgia. I personally don't believe in utopias, and I don't think that communism is the answer to problems today. But I personally don't want to live in a world where we stop fighting to create a better world.
That's a really good point, Mark.
And I want just a quote here. Perhaps you'll recognize
real
this
quick,
communist thinker. People no longer obsess over the accumulation with things. We've eliminated hunger, want, the need for possessions. We've grown out of our infancy. That's the famous communist explorer and commander Jean-Luc Picard of the Starship Enterprise.
Okay. We need Starfleet and a flag here. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Absolutely fascinating discussion. Watch the extended version of RT's YouTube channel. Many thanks to our guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.